civilization will alter. Intelligent management of the earth, resources become the common heritage for humanity. Behold a new world where the laws of man and religion will be erased.
KBOO Community Radio is always looking for ways people can work with us and support us. KBOO has a wish list, and we'd love help getting some of those items donated. Some things on our list include a color printer, digital recorders, a pop-up canopy, dishwashing detergent, brooms and mops, or services like roofing, plumbing, and electrical work. Please contact station co-manager Delphine at del@kboo.org or go to kboo.fm/KBOO's wishlist for more information about supporting your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the benefit screening of Arresting Power, Resisting Police Violence in Portland, Oregon, on Friday, July 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Portland. Arresting Power documents the history of conflict between the Portland police and community members throughout the past 50 years. The film features personal stories of resistance told by victims of police misconduct, the families of people who were killed by police, and members of Portland reform and abolition movements. The screening is a benefit for the Portland chapter of the NAACP. Again, that's a screening of the documentary film Arresting Power, Friday, July 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center, 5431 Northeast 20th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9:01 and time for public affairs programming for Wednesday, July 5th. Here's what we've got for you at 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Sojourner Truth looks at the Oscar-nominated documentary If a Tree Falls about the modern radical environmental movement. And then at 11 o'clock, we've got the Bike Show bringing you news and views of cycling from Portland and beyond. But we begin the morning with the politics of living, welcoming the co-founder of Trackers Earth to discuss nature skills and raising healthy children. Plus, local musician Darka Dusty contributes her song Church of the Get Down. And we thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not yet a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Stand by, please. This is KBOO, KBOO Portland. We're trying to make this tape work. And let's listen to a little music until we get there. Thank you.
Tomi pesa mpona ekolo to botama ba kongole to totikala ba kongole olinga te ekolo mosusu e akokabola mboka biteni mitema ya ba kongole ekomi kopela na ba moto ya souffrance tokomi nde lelo na nsuka panso tolamuka tolandela mboka boyakani toyokana Kande solution ya Congo Kogunda peko swana swana Nakati na biso lelo totika
Must know that the Congolese people need peace. In order to have that peace, now is the time to help the Congo to regain its integrity.
welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Denise Kovalchuk. Every part of our lives is filled with politics, food, relationships, work, living. Politics are right there. They're in the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the music we listen to. On today's program, we meet Brian Tibbetts of the Independent Printing Resource Center. We also hear a little ditty by local musician Darka Dusty, and we have a new segment, The She-Ra Solution. But first, contributing producer Tave Fache-Drake and co-host Brian Delaney invited Trackers Earth co-founder Molly Dice into the studio. They talked about nature skills, the connection between literature and learning, and most importantly, how to raise healthy children.
We'd like to welcome to the studio Molly Dice, educator, blogger, mother, and friend. My first introduction to trackers was nearly a decade ago while working on the documentary Play Again. Soon after, my eldest daughter got involved and is still a part of the trackers community. Thanks for being with us today, Molly.
Thanks for joining us today, Molly.
Yeah, my name is Molly Dice. I work with Trackers Earth. I grew up not necessarily knowing that there was this group of people interested in wilderness survival skills, but my passion came from reading books like the Little House on the Prairie books. Through the adventure of the kids in it, they actually taught you real skills. My side of the mountain, with relationships to tanning his own hide and finding food to eat. It was all in there from a pretty easy to access way as a kid. Wow. I really appreciated the self-sufficiency skills, cooking, gardening, being alone in the woods, having that confidence to go outside with my pocket knife and a pack of birthday candles and some matches, my cats trailing behind me, and we'd see what we could find. And a lot of it for me actually did revolve around what you could eat in nature. I didn't know as much about wild edible plants at that point, but we'd be outside for hours picking blackberries, the Oregon wild iris and wild roses and daffodils and those kinds of plants, which aren't indigenous to the area, but were brought in by a pioneer. So there was that remnant of pioneer living that was left behind.
When I was younger, my grandparents lived out past Labiche, north of Salem. My sister and I, we would spend all day out in the cherry orchards and peach orchards, just climbing around in the filbert trees, digging holes. And then when we'd get hungry, you always had something to eat. It was a fun thing.
My dad grew up in Southeast Alaska, so we did a lot of fishing and being connected with the landscape when we went up and visited. My grandmother did wild plant harvesting for foods because they didn't get a lot of fresh produce. All the produce came up on the barges and it was mostly canned, so people up there did a lot of hunting and living off the land.
We have some other visitors in our studio today. We have Annie and Maxine. But that just reminds me of your wonderful blog and the different posts that you've had on youth foraging. Maybe you would talk a little bit about that from a mother's perspective.
For me personally, it is easy to sit inside on the computer and do work and not take the time to go outside, but you can't do that when kids are around. I don't want them to see me on the computer all day long, then they think that's okay. I want them to be outside running around, and one thing that really motivates them is being able to nibble on things. It's a fun thing to do. Their confidence level when they go outside is great. Every day they're going further, they're wanting to do more. It doesn't necessarily matter if it's rainy or cold, and they know when their favorite wild edibles are growing and where to find them, and they just run along with fistfuls of the stuff and eat them. So that's really great to see. One thing that you want to do with kids or adults is make sure you have a really proper identification. We will point out anything that's a toxic lookalike or even just toxic plants, and we say, I don't want you picking this, but this is something you can pick.
What are some things that you might find this time of year that you particularly like?
A few of my favorites, oxalis, which is also called wood sorrel, or we call it sour grass. It's a bright, vibrant green, three-leaf, almost like a clover, but it grows in wooded areas. They have a really sour flavor, almost like a green apple. Mm. Also right now, the dandelion, that's one of my favorite. You can eat the leaves, you can eat them raw, put them in the salad, you can saute them up, add butter and garlic and all those good flavors. And you can also pick the flower and eat it raw. You can batter it and make a fritter, dandelion wine, and those lots of really fun ways to do dandelion
I just remember as a kid, I had to cut a large lawn, and those dandelions, I didn't know I could have eaten them all these years.
Nature's providing stuff for young and old alike, yeah, for all sorts, yeah, of palates.
Absolutely, and talk about different flavors. The dandelions have this really like bitter flavor. The more you eat it, the more your palate becomes adjusted, and it's a really healthy thing. There are other plants out there, like miner's lettuce, which is coming up wild in the woods right now, and that's a very mild, sweet, kind of watery, edible, most people would enjoy eating. And the nettles. We are in the thick of nettle season, and they grow so fast, and you want to pick the younger leaves kind of on the top by plucking the leaf. The sting actually is on the underside of it, and you can see the little barbs. So if you pluck the leaf from the top and don't touch the underside, and then fold in the leaves on top of those barbs and squish them around a little bit, you can eat it raw without having to worry about getting stung. When you pick nettle, of course, wearing gloves is a must, and that's not necessarily one to do with little kids. We've tried that, and there were some tears, and we didn't finish that project at the time.
I know when I was pregnant, I always had iron poor blood, so my midwife had said, drink a lot of nettle tea. But it wasn't until I had already had kids that I realized, oh, we can just pick nettles and use them like spinach.
Yeah, nettles are great. You can use them on a lot of different things. Tea, like Tave said, and that was actually my first introduction to nettles as well, and I really enjoyed the flavor. And gosh, with nettle in the past, I have made nettle pesto, nettle patties. It's like a spinach patty, but instead of the spinach, you add the nettle. We have friends that have made nettle pastas, nettle gnocchi, nettle raviolis. There's a lot you can do with nettle. And even just adding it to something that you're stir frying is a really great way of using it.
Or in a soup.
In a soup. Actually, I was gonna save that one. But yeah, nettle soup, basically, you could use it as a substitute for any kind of greens, kale, spinach, and any kind of soup. But you could also make a really nice, thick, blended soup with it.
And maybe even it would make sense to try putting some of the dandelion greens in with it, too.
That would be really tasty and probably give a lot of really great flavor and a variety of nutrients. I think it'd be a great idea.
Being a mother and an educator, how do you inspire the next generation to really care about the earth and to want to be sustainable?
I think kids already have an empathy for the natural world. We just have conversations about it and foster those conversations. We'll bring it up with a perspective of, well, isn't this nice that it's here? Being respectful of where we step, if we're picking plants or trimming wood for arrow shafts or friction fire kits, if you ask a question, well, how can we do this in a respectful way? Enabling them to just think about it a little bit more in their lives. As they get older, they ask more questions, and then they pick up the passion for conservation and the environment. We live in a rural setting, and there's logging that happens, and the kids will comment, I'm really sad that those trees are being cut down. We'll talk about the tree and how long it's been there, what it means to the birds and the environment. And actually, this kind of sad thing happened yesterday. We had these 8 ducklings hatch out. I had to leave for the day. We had a hen who was also sitting on eggs, and she had hopped off and gone outside, and I didn't want to lock her out, so I left it open and got home, and this raven was flying out of the barnyard with a little duckling in its mouth, and I went to the nest, and every single duckling was gone. I was devastated, and I felt bad for the mama duck. She had sat on this nest for 35 plus days without any problems. It just happened to be this day. The ravens or the coyotes or bears that might come through every now and then and grab a duck or grab a chicken. We live in their neighborhood. We live in their backyard. They don't live in my backyard. So I have to remind myself their babies are going to have a good start this spring. It's a sad situation, but it's happened, and it's just concepts that you dialogue with the kids so that they can experience that and be thinking about it as they go through life. As they move through the landscape, it's not just about going hiking or going backpacking. And I think by noticing plants and animals, you build a relationship. And that creates diversity and awareness, I think, for the environment and your world around you. Another really cool thing is that my kids pass on their passion. Grandparents who might not be as keen as dandelions in their lawn, but now aren't going to put pesticides on their lawn because they want to have that safe space for the kids to play, that brings the rings out a little bit further with who you're touching. And I think that every time we have kids and adults who find that passion and connection with what's going on around them in the natural world, they're going to be impassioned to share and conserve and protect and ask what I can do to protect the space that has meant so much to me.
It's going to make me start crying. Were you involved in the Trackers comics?
Yeah, it's really exciting because we've been doing the live action version of what these books are or will be in our camp programs for years and years. So we're trying to capture the excitement that a kid has when they come to a week of camp and they go home and they want that excitement to continue on. So our hope is that they'll be able to take the fictional books or even the guidebooks and, you know, really bring their moms and their dads and their grandparents and their siblings into this conversation. I'm helping write one of the books, and in it, I do talk about real farm things. You know, what do goats do? You know, how something might behave, how cheese is made, you know, similar to Little House on the Prairie, what inspired me. But if you were a kid reading it, you might say, oh, that's kind of how that's done. And playing the story, I'll be able to do some of those things as well.
I love it.
That's so
wonderful. We're going to do one of the comics as radio theater.
I will be really excited to hear that.
Thank you so much, Molly, for coming in and talking to us.
When are we going to get out of this room?
Would you like to be interviewed for our radio show? What's your name?
Annie.
Great. And how old are you?
4. I eat grass.
Well, what have you picked that you think might be good in a soup?
Blueberries, raspberries, and huckleberries, and blackberries, salmon berries, ox salads, and miner's lettuce.
Now's the time for Peace, Love, and Soup Theater.
Oh, goody. Trackers Kids, Issue 1, Page 9. The Field Trip.
Class, this is stinging nettle. Don't touch. It's poisonous.
Actually, you can't touch. Pinch like this, and you won't get stung.
Look at that.
Steamer saute them, and they lose their sting. You can even make stinging nettle tea.
Ooh. Coyote tracks. Let's see where they go.
Actually, the track has no claws and an M-shaped back pad. It's a cougar, not a coyote.
Cougar?
A cougar, not a coyote.
You hear it? Hear the call of the dark-eyed Junco.
Actually, that's a Douglas squirrel alarming.
Because we're off trail in its territory.
We're lost.
Actually, we can find our way back pretty easily.
Find north.
It's lunchtime, so the sun is south of us. North is that way.
Okay.
Backtrack.
We follow cougar tracks in, let's follow our tracks out.
Right.
Story mapping.
There's the elephant tree. The bus is around the corner.
Here we go. Let's get on the bus. Don't trip.
Later that day, back at school.
Josh and Fiona are in charge of all future field trips. I'm going home to make nettle tea.
Let's ring the bell.
You can catch the full episode, as well as other episodes of Peace, Love, and Soup, featuring a significant soup each month, along with culture, cooking, and conversation, by visiting kboo.fm and searching for Peace, Love, and Soup. Thanks to Tave and Brian for that interview. Next up, the Independent Publishing Resource Center was founded by Chloe Udaly, now a Portland City Commissioner, and Rebecca Gilbert. They wanted to explore and create a vision of a resource center for zine creation, letterpress, bookbinding, and printing. Now, their idea was to facilitate creative expression, identity, and community by offering individual access to tools and resources for creating independently published media and artwork. It began above Chloe's bookstore, Reading Frenzy, back in 1998, and now it's time to expand. Contributor Anessa Anderson spoke with interim executive director Brian Tibbetts on how IPRC came into being and the move into a building that is a National Historic Site on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard.
Well, the IPRC is a makerspace, first and foremost. It's a resource center for those who wish to make print art or those who wish to get their voice out in printed form. We offer a variety of different classes and resources for people that want to learn letterpress printing, screen printing, desktop publishing, book binding, and then we also offer longer form certificate program that actually teaches. It's like a surrogate program for like a Master of Fine Arts in creative writing. It's postgraduate level, and meant for folks who want to really study prose or poetry or comics or image and text, and then put that knowledge to work in the print shop, actually producing their own work and sometimes the work of others.
Yeah, my experience with IPRC is that in between, say, you know, gigs that I've done, paying jobs, it's like, oops, lost that one. What do I need to brush up on? And that is what I think Independent Publishing Resource Center is perfect for, because you offer so many different kinds of things. Like, okay, how does Photoshop really work?
Oh, yeah.
How do I do it? Except for the fact that it's gone up in price so much.
Well,
you got to buy something different.
The classes that we offer in the Adobe Creative Suite, if you will, the InDesign, the Photoshop, the Illustrator, that's another great resource that we have at the IPRC as well. It often gets overlooked by the general group of our members who come in to use the print shop or come in for readings or come in to produce like a zine or a chapbook of their own work.
Right, because there's so much stuff that, well, for one thing, digital technology and knowledge is moving so fast that you almost need to brush up. I've been in the middle of the digital world since it began for radio in the 90s, we kind of had to learn it. It was an imperative because that's where it was going. And now, so long ago, I mean, 20-some years later, it's like way out there.
Yeah, and every month it's a new thing.
Yeah, and I feel like I really know a lot. But I think I would recommend IPRC for anybody who wants to, you know, get something new, you know, under their belt, or maybe brush up on, like, you know, the Adobe thing.
Yeah.
Anything, if you have a website of your own, you know, and want to know how to, okay, how do you tag and how do you do this? And, you know, we live in a Facebook world. Are you on Facebook, by the way?
Yes. The IPRC is, and I am as well, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a lot of, you know, even for bands, I think that, you know, anybody who wants to put their word out in any kind of way, it seems like you'd be a wonderful, wonderful resource. So the mission is to facilitate creative expression, quoting you guys, identity and community by providing individual access to books and resources, tools for creating independently published media and artwork. And I'm sure media and artwork these days is much more than when this...
Yeah. It runs the gamut.
Statement was established.
We like to think that we can provide you with the resources to learn how to write and publish all the way from a 16th century perspective all the way up until the current digital era. So depending on what you want to learn, we have the equipment and the instructors to kind of help you figure it out on your own, and that way you can get out and produce your own work. That's the end goal, is that for people to give the people the tools and the knowledge resources to be able to publish their own work. We're trying to build a publishing community as opposed to publishing companies.
Right.
That makes sense. So
yeah. Makes sense. Certainly makes sense in Portland, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Interconnectivity that we have here. I've lived in Milwaukee now for several years, and it was a pleasure to bring in somebody from Northeast Alberta for an overnight while her husband is doing an install event in Berlin. So, I mean, Portland is a real hub for all kinds of people.
Yeah.
But she doesn't drive, so it was our pleasure to take her back to Northeast Alberta, which was our old haunt on Emerson, over there by Killingsworth. And we, you know, because once you get into your own neighborhood, you don't get out very much. I think it's really, especially if you work from home like I do. But I told my hubs, oh, this is where the hipsters live. Okay, got it.
Well, one enclave anyway.
One enclave.
Well, you got to go out to St. John's if you really want to be on the cutting edge of hipster of gentrification hipster. Right yeah. now. Or my neighborhood out in Montevilla.
Oh, yeah, Montevilla, sure. Yeah.
Not that I'm, yeah, just tar myself with the hipster brush there. But yeah, Portland is definitely the kind of community in which the IPRC thrives. Frankly, we serve what I believe to be a vital role in our local community, and it's a resource center that is. I don't know that it could have grown into what it has in very many cities in the country, but I would love to believe that every city the size of Portland or larger should have something like the IPRC available for their local writers and printmakers and just people who want to, you know, invest in media literacy and in mm-hmm. getting their own voice out in print form.
And one thing I did want to say when I jumped in there for a couple of weeks seminar, the you really do accommodate people who are like, I don't have the money.
Yeah, well,
it's accommodation.
It's a community-based organization. Mm-hmm. We try everything. We do everything we can to keep membership and fees down as low as we possibly can. I mean, our base membership fee is only $6 a month currently.
That's almost silly.
Yeah.
I mean, considering what Netflix costs a month.
Well, yes, and we do that intentionally. I mean, there are other fees associated with the classes we teach in letterpress and screen printing and zine
and you
making.
You have to pay for your stuff that you use.
There are ink up fees. We're actually looking at retooling membership so it makes a little more sense to. We're looking at retooling membership so there are different levels. So there'll mm-hmm. be a membership level that's just a base membership level if you want to come in and use the computers and the printers and the digital kind of parts of it, but don't necessarily want to pay for access to screen printing or letterpress. And then there'll be a membership level above that that's for people that specifically are using the letterpress and screen printing studios and the bookbinding equipment. And then some other supporting memberships for folks that just want to contribute a higher level to help the IPRC fulfill its mission in the community.
Who knows what's going to happen like in 5 years? Who knows?
Yeah, the whole Adobe suite may phase out in favor of something else, or the mediums may change. But I had to learn DOS once because one of my computers got infected with a virus, and I couldn't DOS was the only way to harvest what I needed off the hard drive. I lost a whole bunch of my writing.
Oh, God. Isn't that just horrible when you think about it?
It's an opportunity, right? You learn a new skill based on the calamity of the moment. Doesn't feel like it at the time, though, does it?
Yeah, it's so true. So true. So I wanted to go back to the very beginnings. It was 1998 that IPRC came to be, and it was founded by two women with a vision. Tell me what they felt and what they saw could happen at these two women.
Well, I don't know that I'm qualified to speak for either Chloe Udaly or Rebecca Gilbert, but as far as I understand the story, and this is well before my time with the IPRC, I've only been involved with the IPRC for the last 3 years, but back in 98...
You were aboard, right? But you were on the board.
Oh, I was on the board, yeah. I thought you said I was bored. I'm like, that's why I decided to join the board. No. We can talk about my story in a minute if you still want
to. Sure.
But as far as the IPRC being founded, it was founded in a space above the Reading Frenzy bookstore downtown by the owner then of Reading Frenzy.
Remind me where Reading Frenzy was.
Reading Frenzy was in that triangle block kind of kitty corner from Powell's.
Okay,
on the opposite side of Burnside, kind of halfway down that block that's not on Burnside. I forget what the cross street is, but... might be Stark or Washington or something, but so Chloe Udaly founded Reading Frenzy way back in the 90s. Rebecca Gilbert went on to found Stumptown Printers and is still there, but the two of them together had this vision for a resource center for people that predominantly for people that wanted to make their own zines. So a zine, by definition, being something a piece of writing or artwork that's self-produced and self-published for the sheer joy of getting your vision out there.
That was kind of a thing then, wasn't it?
Well, it's still kind of a thing now. And the IPRC, I didn't mention this earlier, but the IPRC has the largest zine library in North America. Several thousand titles between the archive and what's actually on display right now. We're currently beginning the work to kind of revamp it and make it a little easier to search. Hopefully, once we get into our new space, and we'll talk about that in a minute, we'll have the... the zine library will again begin to flourish and
become
a resource.
And can anybody come in to the zine library and browse? Is it like a library in that sense? Or do you have to be a member? Or what's the qualification? Just as an aside.
We're pretty lenient on letting people come in and just look at things.
Yeah,
it's
because
not
that,
like
you
we're
going
to force you to buy a membership just so you can look at the zine library. Generally speaking, we like people to become members if they're going to use the resources that we have
that
in the center.
Sense. Yeah, it's kind of like paying for your library card.
Yeah, we get a certain amount of funding from granting foundations and other granting bodies, both government and private. But really, the majority of the revenue that we use to operate the center comes from memberships and member fees. So we generally like, that's why we keep them so low, so it's an encouragement to get people to join with what we're doing if they're going to use the resources. To get back to the founding, the original IPRC was just a couple of rooms on the second floor of this building above Reading Frenzy. And they started out basically with a table, a saddle stapler, a printer, and a couple of computers, and
a
saddle stapler is what you use to print, like if you're going to print like 8.5 by 11 and then fold it in half, you need a longer stapler in order to get the staples into that.
Thanks
those
for
are
clarifying.
Called saddle staplers, of which we have several in the IPRC now, and they're always in use.
So anyway, so there they started with these two rooms above Reading Frenzy.
Above Reading Frenzy, and then about 5.5 years ago, it was decided that we needed to make the jump to the east side of the river into bigger digs to kind of expand on what we'd initially started.
And you figured the east side because it would be cheaper to get a bigger dig on the east side.
Because 5 years ago, it was cheaper to get bigger space on the east side.
Now not so much, right?
Now maybe not so much, yeah. Well, development, anybody who's listened to this understands what's been going on.
Those buildings that are popping up along the east side?
Well, and a lot of the east side's being rezoned as a direct result of the development or gentrification, depending on how you want to look at it, that's going on the east side has caused a lot of buildings to get rezoned. In fact, the building that we're in currently and moving out of at
and
the end
of
the
division,
month.
And you're on Division and what right now?
10th and Division.
Oh, you're close in.
Yeah, right across the street from the Ford building, right near that pocket that's just being developed, kind of right around there with breweries and little boutiques and sandwich shops and coffee shops. And it's fantastic to see all that happening. But when all that happens and your building gets rezoned, all of a sudden your rent goes from being, you know, reasonable for a nonprofit of our size to being three times as high as it was before, which forced us to start looking for a new place about a year ago. And I'm happy to report that we found one that's reasonable. It's still a rent increase of approximately 100%, but it's not the rent increase we were looking to stay where
so
we are.
So that's what Chloe Daly and Rebecca Gilbert were looking at when they found their place. They needed to find a bigger place. And now here, nearly 20 years later, you've got a...
I'm not sure how involved Chloe and Rebecca still were 5 years ago when the IPRC moved. At the time, we had an executive director named Justin Hawking and A.M. O'Malley was actually a part of that. She went on to become our executive director. And I believe Pollyann Faith Burge, who was also an executive director at one point.
So it kept on being handed over to willing hands.
To willing hands. And eventually that team moved it across and then greatly expanded
it. IPRC was above the Reading Frenzy for many years.
For many years. Until about 5 years ago, yes.
Oh, really?
So from its founding in 98 till, I want to say, 2012, it existed in those small rooms above Reading Frenzy. And part of the move across the river was to try to get into a space where we could grow. So they went. I couldn't even tell you how many square feet we had in the downtown facility. But the facility that we're currently in and moving out of is roughly 3,700 square feet. It's considerably larger and allowed us to grow the letterpress offerings. It allowed us to begin offering screen printing. Allowed us to bring in all the bookbinding equipment we have now. Allowed us to start the certificate program just increase the volume of the certificate program by adding classrooms, and we also increased the size of the zine library all at the same time.
But it was so fairly recent from 2012 to now, 12, 30, 40, 50, 60, 17, that's another 5 years. I'm wondering how many women thought, I can do a zine, because I always thought it was kind of a guy's thing, you know, back when it first got going. I don't even know when that first was.
I'm not sure. Yeah, the original punk rock zines, I'm not sure how gender divided that may have been back at the time. Now I can vouch for the fact that it we have a very diverse crowd at the IPRC, and if I had to guess, I would say it's probably more women than men that use the center on a regular basis, although it's it seems, you know, comparable, the size of the groups.
Yeah. Well, I think that women have stepped into so many different places that they weren't in. Mm-hmm. And before, we have seen that happen over and over again, you know. It's nice to see that progression.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we like to see. For everybody, really. I'm not just talking about women per se, but, mm-hmm. you know, people of all ages. I think that's really important, too. Mm-hmm. That age shouldn't, you know, elders should not be discouraged from learning a new thing. In fact, I think it's a good thing to learn something new, no matter what age you're at.
No, and I think that's something we definitely can do more of at the IPRC, is engaging with elder communities around the greater Portland metro area. We do a lot with schools, a lot with kids, but sometimes...
Do you go out into schools?
Oh, yes. We get asked on a regular basis to come and do media literacy programming or zine-making workshops.
Oh, what fun.
In local schools. So we're constantly doing it. It's not directly in the mission, but it's one of the ways we serve the mission.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that because you never know what a fourth grader might catch on to, mm-hmm. and say, wow, they just realized what they want to do, mm-hmm. for the rest of their life, and they don't know it then.
You got to plant the spark at some point, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that, just the idea that you can do this on your own. You don't need an institution necessarily. I mean, the IPRC is an institution, granted. But it's meant as a resource center to give people what they need to be able to do things on their own. It's not about having to serve the institution in order to get the product, like the standard publishing model where you have to serve, you know, the apparatus of the publishing company, or in these days, media conglomerate, in order to get your voice heard.
Yeah.
The IPRC gives you a way to do that on your own.
Very, very important work. I've always liked what IPRC does. Well, let's talk about the new home.
The new home.
Now, 5 years later, you're moving again.
We're moving, yeah.
So you secured a new home. How long did it take to find something?
Oh, we looked for 15 months at least. I want to say, yeah, 15 months sounds appropriate. I believe it was in March of last year that we found out that our rent would be increased if we chose to stay. And then began to look in earnest. And we were looking for both. We had a very generous benefactor, a member of our community, come forward and offer to purchase a building up to a certain point, you know, in terms of what it would cost to purchase a building. And then we were also simultaneously looking for places that made sense to rent. And we just ended up finding a place to rent before we ever found a place to purchase. But yeah, it was a 15-month hunt with a couple of potential deals that just never really penciled out, unfortunately. But now we're very, very happy to report that we found a great space in the Gardeners and Ranchers building at 1305 Southeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard.
Remind me, and for our listeners, visually, where that is on MLK. Gardeners and Ranchers building. It's mm-hmm. it's on MLK at 13th.
No,
it's on 13th.
It's 13 blocks south of Burnside on MLK.
On
so,
MLK.
Okay. Yeah, so it's directly, it takes up a full city block, the building does, between MLK and 3rd and Main and Madison. So the Madison Viaduct.
Mm-hmm.
It's a viaduct, yeah. I'll keep wanting to say vestibule. Yeah. The Madison Viaduct that hooks up to the Hawthorne Bridge,
uh-huh.
is covers... Madison Street, right?
Right, right.
So the buildings
that's
in between
the,
Madison
that's on
and
the
Main.
West, yeah. If you're heading to Milwaukee, it's going to mm-hmm. be in the
on your right hand side.
Mm-hmm,
yeah, if you're heading south on MLK, it'll be on your yeah. right hand side just before you see the Hawthorne Bridge.
Underneath all that stuff over there, all those buildings right there as you come up on the viaduct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Because there are so many old buildings underneath there. You don't know what's in there unless you have to go there for some reason.
Unless you could. Yeah, there's
Isn't
a lot
there like
of
a restaurant down
whatnot.
There? What is it?
There's a new ramen shop that's closer down by Water Avenue,
yeah.
where Water and Madison come together. But yeah. we're not actually under the bridge. The south side of our building kind of is right there where the Madison
so
Viaduct
that's
is.
That's the historic Gardeners and Ranchers building. Mm-hmm. National Historic Site.
Yes, the Italian Gardeners and Ranchers, I believe, society or association. They built the building in 1922 as a place where they could sell their produce that they trucked into town from their local farms and gardens and ranches in the area. It's now just called the Gardeners and Ranchers Building, and it's only been owned by two different groups in its entire life.
And
as
that's
a building,
the on the original Produce Row, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so now
well, nearby the old Cornos and
yeah, the Cornos that's gone. And,
yeah, the Cornos. Yeah, if you've been around Portland long enough, you remember Cornos. It's a few blocks down
yeah,
from there.
Yeah.
I'd say 5 or 6 blocks down from the Sheridan Market.
You know, I'm so glad that you're moving in there because it's things like that revitalize an area. I mean, they give it life. Mm-hmm. Instead of tearing things down, that you move in with your mission statement mm-hmm. to do this thing for the community, you know, to facilitate creative expression, identity. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, this is what we need to maintain Portland as Portland, because I think a lot of people feel like Portland's changing. There's so much traffic. There's, you know, clubs that we used to know are being closed down because they're being torn down, and, you know, they can't afford to keep them there. And that's kind of the talk of the town right now among the creatives.
Yeah, the new Portland, old Portland.
You being a musician, you probably know that.
Yeah, most of the places that were available for local musicians to play back in the 90s are gone now. Most of the art venues where you could show your work if you were a young artist are gone now. Most of the venues that used to host poetry open mics and various readings are gone, but they've been replaced by a new crop of places to play music or show your artwork or read your work in front of an audience. It's a different city than it used to be, but it's not necessarily all bad change. Some of it's just more challenging. So one of the things the IPRC is trying to do, like every other mid-sized nonprofit, especially mid-sized arts nonprofits in Portland, is to stay vital and find ways to continue to fundraise and serve the communities that they were initially founded to serve. And this building gives us an opportunity to do that. And one of the great things about the Gardeners and Ranchers building is it's already full of a bunch of very similar little companies, people making their own furniture, making their own metal works, making artwork
like
of very different
craft,
kinds.
Small craft kind of things.
And there's a Oni Comics is in there. In fact, we're taking over part of their old space will be the new IPRC, and the print shop that we're going to build in another site within the same building used to be a screen printing shop that has now moved out to the suburbs. So
this reminds me of the Townsend Storage.
Yeah.
You know, that some very dear friends of mine, Catherine Clare, shout out to my musician friend, she had her studio and the whole thing was mm-hmm. there. You know, several photographer friends that I had there, and everybody got the boot from that wonderful communal space.
Yeah, it's been challenging watching that happen in Portland as development money has come in and kind of snatched up a lot of those old cheap places that we all thought of as communal resources.
Well,
turns out somebody owned them and somebody else wanted them more.
I remember from my time in New York, the new craze it was the loft spaces, and they tried to stop people from doing loft spaces, but you can't.
First it was the condos, then it was the lofts, now it's the mixed use developments. Not to pick on anybody that moved into any of those mixed-use developments on Division, but that's what drove our rent up so high, was the development of that area. And there's good and challenging aspects to that development.
I like to think that, I don't like to think necessarily, but Foster's, you know, one of those streets that's
happening.
Going up the, you know, right now it's just a lot of Russian restaurants and a lot of Asian goody places, a lot of pot shops.
Well, the legalization of marijuana, regardless how you feel about it personally, has actually driven up rent for a lot of nonprofits and makerspaces in Portland as well, because a lot of the available warehouse space that could have been used for making artwork, making print, was rented by places either growing or processing marijuana for the new market. And, you know, it's another aspect of the crunch that's kind of happening around the city for small arts nonprofits and medium-sized ones as well.
Independent Publishing Resource Center, Fighting the Good Fight. This whole month, July, really, mid-July or so, is going to be all about moving, which who doesn't love moving?
The big trucks show up and all the heavy equipment gets moved over. And then the following week, we get to clean and try to repair our old space to get our deposits back and all that. And then,
any idea who's coming in there?
We'll see what shows up.
Yeah.
Could be anything. At this point, it's Portland. Who knows what's going to be in there? But, so we ask our community to be patient with us. It's going to take us a while to redistribute everything into the new space and make it usable for the public. But we're hoping to be open at least limited hours in support of the Portland Zine Symposium. So currently the target date is the 17th, but I'm really hoping
July
for limited hours. I'm really hoping we can push it and start on the 11th, though, But we'll see. We'll see how quickly we can get into there. There's a lot of things that need to be accomplished before that date can really be firmed up. But currently we're saying we'll have something open by the 17th at the very latest.
So the Oregon Zine Symposium.
Mm-hmm. That's the following weekend. So we want to be open for days in advance of that so zine makers can come in and print and
Do their
saddle
thing.
Staple and, then, and all the rest of that.
Yeah, exactly. So you're hoping to do the grand reopening bash to coincide with back to school time, and that would be the end of August.
We're thinking the end of August. We want to firm up the date as we get closer to it. So keep your eye on our social media and on our website, and we'll be broadcasting heavily about the grand reopening, because it'll be a good opportunity for us to fundraise around the new space, but also just we want to have a party for our community to come in and see, not just our community, but anybody that's interested to come in and see what the IPRC is doing.
Right, and have take a tour or whatever.
Exactly.
You'll see what you guys are up to down
see
there.
See the kind of work that is produced in the space. I mean, we're very proud of a lot of the artists and writers and other folks that have come through our certificate program or just members and have learned how to use the space have gone on to produce professional quality work kind of throughout the world. We've had people come through our certificate program that have gone on to found publishing companies that have won Oregon Book Awards or at least been nominated for Oregon Book Awards. There's really a lot of really cool stuff that kind of happens out of the IPRC, but the IPRC is the base where people get started on some of these things, or at least continue their
and there
education.
There are also opportunities for people to teach there, and I noticed that you're currently seeking a couple of really interesting positions. Just to finish out our conversation, why don't we spring this out on maybe some hopeful
okay.
out there?
Yeah, so if you go to the IPRC.org, you will find there's a couple of job announcements up currently. One is for a prose instructor for our certificate program.
So that means prose instructor means that if you or yourself do creative writing, if you like to teach creative writing, maybe you're a poet, poetry. It's really prose that you're talking about, not poetry.
Yeah, we have poetry instructors that teach the poetry track. So the certificate program offers four different tracks of study. One is for comics, one is for image and text, one is for poetry, and then the final one is for prose. So both fiction and nonfiction are taught in the prose track. So what we're looking for is someone who's got experience and enthusiasm for teaching prose in a variety of its manifestations, and then also teaching the book arts part that brings everything that you learn over the course of the year in prose instruction into an actual manifested physical form at the end of it.
So it's a year-long classroom.
Yes, a year-long classroom taught at night. So that's the one job opening that we have currently. The second job opening is for a letterpress studio manager. Caitlin Harris, who has been with the IPRC for the last 7 years first as a volunteer and is now our letterpress studio manager, is moving on to do her MFA at the University of Boise. Boise, I have to say it right, or my friends in Idaho will kill me. But anyway,
I know what you mean.
Yeah, it's Moscow and it's Boise.
Not Moscow
Boise. And Boise.
And it's not Nevada and it's not Colorado. Okay, well, let's not get into
all right, we'll get into the West. But yeah, so we're hiring for a letterpress studio manager as well, someone who has a level of expertise in letterpress printmaking, knows how to kind of keep the often antique machinery and type in working order, keep the shop organized, manage some volunteer coordination, as well as also manage a team of shop stewards that kind of oversee our open letterpress studio hours.
Well, it's been great to meet you, Brian, and to find out more about this work that I keep on hearing about. But when you're perhaps you've been laid off or you're looking for a different direction in your life, and you're kids are going back to school or what, any number of things that maybe free up certain of us in our lives to explore some different avenues.
Oh, yeah.
This is going to be the one to keep in mind.
Yeah, there are a lot of different paths that people take to the IPRC and a lot of different paths you can take out of the IPRC. I mean, I myself came in because I started studying linoleum cut block printmaking and woodcut block printmaking. And that kind of led me to a fascination. Well, how do I incorporate text into these things without having to learn calligraphy, which I had no interest in learning? And then I started getting really interested in letterpress, and I started volunteering at the IPRC. And
like
the rest
you're,
is, as
like
they
you're
say.
A woman who's heading over to Boise, you know, and with her letterpress expertise has allowed her to
Mm-hmm.
Go get her MFA.
Yeah, she's grown and mm-hmm. grown in her position at the IPRC to mm-hmm. the point where she's now pursuing a printmaking MFA degree. Yeah. There are a lot of people that come to the IPRC as volunteers and leave as professionals in one way or the other. It's,
well, kudos to the work that you do, and I'll be interested to see where you land and if it's still going to be with IPRC. Any thoughts on that?
I'm interim director. I was on the board for 2 years before A.M. O'Malley left for Alabama. Our last executive director moved with her partner to start a family in Alabama. So I volunteered to step down from the board to kind of guide the IPRC and to lead our efforts to find a new home so that we could do a nationwide executive director search once we'd located a new home. It seemed like too much to dump on the plate of a
brand new ED. So that's still in progress then.
So we will be starting a nationwide search for a new executive director once we get the move accomplished. So look out for announcements for that in August. We're hoping to have somebody in place by September or October, definitely by the end of the year. Yeah.
Thank you for helping close the door onto the division home and helping open it up to the MLK home.
Yeah.
It's been great talking with you, Brian. Right.
Thank you very much. Annette.
Thank you.
That was Annessa Anderson chatting with Brian Tibbetts of the IPRC. You can learn more about the expansion and all their resources by visiting their website, www.iprc.org. You are listening to The Politics of Living on KBOO Radio. Recently, I took my daughter to see the Wonder Woman film just a few weeks back, and the film brought up some really fantastic conversations with her about power, strength, and, well, basically women kicking butt. Now, both of us hope that there's going to be more films out in the world showcasing women in all kinds of powerful situations. Now, in the meantime, contributor Kristen Thiel came up with this idea to showcase the contributions of women of the past and the present day. And in this first installment of a new segment here on The Politics of Living, it's called the She-Ra Solution. She's going to introduce us to two Wonder Women, activist Sophie Scholl and journalist Anne Morrissey Merrick.
Welcome to the She-Ra Solution, a new regular feature on The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Kristen Thiel. Every month, we'll learn a little bit about women who are inverting the world we've been taught to expect. When we first started talking about producing a feature like this, our thoughts pretty immediately turned to Wonder Woman as a point of inspiration for what we were going to talk about. That movie has become the highest-grossing live-action film to be directed by a woman, and of course, it stars a woman. People are turning out to watch and cheer for a female character who's taking charge and taking names. Globally, this DC film has beat the numbers for Marvel's Iron Man, which nearly 10 years ago launched what has become a huge success for Marvel. We can expect only the same leadership from Wonder Woman. Talk about exactly the kind of people I wanted to profile on this radio program. I started looking online for more inspiration and found a year-long article in The Atlantic called She-Ra and the Fight Against the Token Girl. In it, author Maria Teresa Hart looked at superhero She-Ra's role in kids' television. TV cartoons, hugely popular in the 1980s, were important to our personal narratives, yet they by and large focused on males. She-Ra offered something different. Her value as a person was not defined by her value to men. She-Ra did not end up breaking audience and money records, but her show did counter what writer Katha Pollitt called the Smurfette principle. A group of male buddies will be accented by a lone female, stereotypically defined, as happened on the TV cartoon The Smurfs, among so many others. Instead, She-Ra offered what Hart called in her Atlantic article, the She-Ra solution. That term resonated with me for this radio feature. She-Ra provided a solution to the model that snuffed out alternatives in which women, just like men, could lead, fight, and prevail. In today's segment, we talk about activist Sophie Scholl and journalist Anne Morrissey Merrick. Scholl, who stood up to the Nazis and was executed for it, has been called by German media a symbol of moral courage. She was born on May 9, 1921, to Magdalena and Robert, and lived with them and her four siblings in the southern German city of Ulm. When the National Socialists took power in 1933, Scholl joined the Union of German Girls and within 2 years was a leader in the Nazi Party. Just as quickly, though, she began to question the government and the atrocities she was learning about. Along with her brother Hans and three friends, Scholl became a founding member of the resistance group, the White Rose. "Why," one of their pamphlets asked citizens, "do you allow these men who are in power to rob you?" It warned that one day nothing at all will be left but a mechanized state system presided over by criminals. And it reminded people that it wasn't just their right, but their moral duty to eliminate such evil. Scholl was eventually arrested, tried, and convicted of high treason. In her statement before the court, the 21-year-old argued that we absolutely should not simply adapt to a conflicting world. How can we expect righteousness to prevail when there is hardly anyone who will give himself up to a righteous cause? She asked. She was executed on February 22, 1943. Before her death, she said, "What does my death matter if through us thousands of people are awakened and stirred to action?" On May 2, 2017, exactly 1 week shy of what would have been Scholl's 96th birthday, Anne Morrissey Merrick died in Naples, Florida. Like Scholl, she too had stood up during wartime. She was born Anne Louise Morrissey in New York City on October 28, 1933, to parents Catherine and John. In 1954, she became the first woman to be named sports editor of the Cornell University Daily Sun, a newspaper that had been in existence for 74 years. This student news made national headlines, but not in a complimentary way. One New York Herald Tribune columnist wrote that she was a slick little chick whose name probably will be linked in history with those of other crusading cupcakes. But, her daughter later told the New York Times, her being allowed to cover major college sports really set her up to not be afraid to do the job of a man. Indeed, by 1967, Morrissey Merrick was covering the Vietnam War for ABC News. She was not the first reporter to horrify military command by being a woman on the battlefield, but she was the one who organized female reporters to speak up for their rights to cover the war. When General William C. Westmoreland took it upon himself to bar journalists who were female from embedding with the troops, he effectively kept them from doing their jobs. In that war, the front was always moving. Action could start anywhere at any time. If women weren't allowed to stay overnight, they couldn't go on most missions. Morrissey Merrick organized her colleagues to appeal to the U.S. Defense Department. She believed it crucial that the public hear from journalists living with the soldiers. By being allowed full access to the war, she got the story behind the story, she said. Not only what these men did, but how they felt about it. There are little coincidences that link Sophie Scholl and Anne Morrissey Merrick. One was born in May and the other died in May. One was starting her life at the very time the other was starting her political life. But, of course, those parallels aren't of much importance. What matters are the deeper threads linking these two people. We understand today, clear as anything, how important not only direct action is, but also quality media coverage of it. As we look back across time and space, Scholl and Morrissey Merrick worked together to show us how important that partnership has always been. We must effect positive change, and we must tell the stories of the change makers in order that more progress be had. That's the She-Ra Solution for July 2017. A list of references used in this episode is on the Politics of Living page on the KBOO website, kboo.fm. I'm your host, Kristen Thiel, and I'll be back next month.
That was the She-Ra Solution with Kristen Thiel. It's a new monthly segment here on the Politics of Living, showcasing the contributions of women of the past and present. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Politics of Living. We're going to close out with a piece by local musician Darka Dusty. Now, a little backstory to this song. She wrote it about 10 years ago as a fundraiser for Pendarvis Farm. Now, that might sound familiar to you. It's the site of the Pickathon Music Festival. Now, back in 2008, the farm was facing a big problem, big change, actually. The city of Happy Valley was trying to build a road right through the farm's main field where horses hang out and, well, the main stage is located for Pickathon. Now, the song that Darka wrote, Church of the Get Down, is a title track from a whole record that Darka produced. She gathered about over 50 musicians, and over the course of 6 months, recorded original songs in secret and put together a CD of those songs to show the Pendarvises how much they appreciated the farm and its place in the music community. It was a fundraiser to help them with their legal fees. Well, the road would have spoiled this beautiful space, but the Pendarvises fought it, and they won. And a big part of that was the help with this fundraising CD. So before we get to that song, I want to do a big shout-out to our contributors, Kristen Thiel, Anessa Anderson, and Tave Fashe Drake. Also, thanks to our technical editor, Liam Delta, and our webpage goddess, Vicky Mazzone. And thanks to you, listener, for tuning in today to The Politics of Living. I'm Denise Kowalczyk. Now here's that song by Darka Dusty, Church of the Get Down. Have a great day.
It's 10 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. That was The Politics of Living. And next, we're going to hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15, Sojourner Truth looks at the Oscar-nominated documentary If a Tree Falls about the modern radical environmental movement. At 11 o'clock, stay tuned for The Bike Show, bringing you news and views of cycling from Portland and beyond. And once again, we thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're just a listener but you'd like to become a member, you can become one very easily when you go to kboo.fm and click on donate. Stay tuned. Air Cascadia is up next.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO.